string of mass mobilizations for this spring that they hope will go beyond the historic immigrant rights protests of 2006, when millions and millions of undocumented and their supporters turned out into the streets of all the major cities in the United States. They're calling on grassroots organizations to culminate those protests in early May, specifically on May 1st, International Workers Day, with a series of labor strikes, not just one, but several days without immigrants, including a Cinco de Mayo walkouts from restaurants and hotels across the country to make clear how critical immigrants are to American capitalism. So it's obvious that the neo-fascist coup we are witnessing will not be defeated by simply by legal challenges in the courts. It will have to be confronted in the streets. And I think that the immigrant rights groups are going to be setting the path for the level of militancy that will be needed.
Well, we're going to look right now at a victory for immigrant rights that came in a legal case on Sunday night, around the same time the musical legend Jon Batiste was singing the Star Spangled Banner at the start of the Super Bowl, attended by President Trump, just days after Trump fired Batiste and others from serving on the board of the JFK Center for Performing Arts. On Sunday evening, our next guest found himself on a video conference with federal judge Kenneth Gonzalez in New Mexico, as the judge temporarily blocked the U.S. government from sending his clients, three Venezuelan men, to the U.S. Navy base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where the Trump administration is preparing a 30,000-person detention center. Bahar Azmi is legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which sought an emergency order to protect the three men who'd been held for about a year at the Otero Detention Center for re-entering the United States. The men say they left Venezuela to request asylum in the U.S., but were rejected. When they saw others from the detention center transferred to Guantanamo, they feared they could be next, and asked the judge to preemptively block their transfer. Over the weekend, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem visited Guantanamo days after the first detained immigrants were flown there. She claimed, without evidence, on CNN that the people deported there were dangerous criminals.
These individuals are the worst of the worst that we pulled off of our streets.
Who are they?
Murderers, rapists. When I was there, I was able to watch one of the flights landing and them unload about 15 different of these criminals. Those were mainly child pedophiles, those that were out there trafficking children, trafficking drugs, and were pulled off of our streets and put at this facility.
This comes as the Trump administration recently withdrew temporary protected status for Venezuelans living here in the U.S. Bahar Azmi joins us now for more on this case filed with the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico, Las Américas Immigrant Advisory Center, its recent article for Slate. We'll talk about that in a minute. So Sunday night, or more than 100 million people are watching the Super Bowl, but you're on a conference call. How did this happen?
Once our clients had some credible information that they might be transferred to Guantanamo, after all, they fit the profile of Venezuelans in detention in New Mexico, we decided we had to move and prevent their transfer, their rendition to the lawless space in Guantanamo. And our team from CCR in Las Americas and ACLU of New Mexico worked around the clock and filed an emergency motion Sunday, maybe at 5. And as I don't remember who was playing, but within an hour, the judge asked for a conference call. Our team got on. He took it from the side of the road and agreed that there's too much of a risk to our ability to access our clients and to the court's jurisdiction to allow the government to transfer them. So he issued an order forbidding their transfer to Gitmo.
And could you talk about the challenges faced by immigration and human rights advocates in dealing with this Guantanamo situation, given the fact that there aren't even you don't even have the names of the people who are being shipped there?
Yeah, thanks, Juan. This is like a grim deja vu from 2001, early 2002, when the then lawless Guantanamo prison was populated by, as Noem repurposed the worst of the worst. That was what was said about the Muslim men and boys who were sent there. And then, as now, had no idea the identities of people there, their legal status, or at least the administration's position regarding the legal status. And then, as of now, Guantanamo just represents this security theater. It's a kind of performative cruelty that, you know, stamps people simply by virtue of their placement there as dangerous. It's an utterly manufactured kind of performance to show muscularity through vengeance.
In addition to Bahar Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, we're joined by Vince Warren, executive director of CCR. And Vince, I wanted to ask you about the constitutional crisis that is looming in this country. Many of Trump's executive orders have already been temporarily halted. Already a judge has said he is not obeying his order to start the funds flowing at the Treasury that have been approved by Congress. Yet you have Vice President J.D. Vance writing on X, that's the richest man in the world's platform, Elon Musk's platform. Vice President J.D. Vance said, judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. Your response?
That is 100% not true. And we've been actually talking for many years about when does a constitutional crisis present itself. And I'm here to say that this is the moment. The question that we're all facing is that when courts issue legitimate orders to get the government to do things that it should do or to stop doing things that it shouldn't do or to comply with the law, and the administration says, yeah, we don't really have to comply with that. That's the definition of a constitutional crisis. And we're seeing that in that possibility in just about everything. In terms of the temporary restraining order that we got in Guantanamo, what's the guarantee that they're going to show up to court and, with an adverse ruling, stop transferring people? What's the guarantee that they're going to release the funds that courts order them to do? There is no guarantee precisely because this administration has been built on lies and the idea that it is actually that the law just doesn't apply to them. What applies to them are their political points. So we have a administration that is really moving to seize the pillars of our constitutional system and our laws and to rip them to shreds, not only just to test them, but to just destroy them. We are actually facing a constitutional crisis on a range of issues, and it's just not clear to any of us whether this administration will actually comply with the rule of law in any context.
And Vince, this use of Guantanamo Bay, not simply to as a detention center for or as a black hole prison for suspected terrorists, but Guantanamo was used even before that to house thousands of Haitians and Cubans who were trying to get to migrate into the United States. And interestingly, Rudy Giuliani was back then, before he was even mayor of New York, he was in the Justice Department, involved in those. Are there any legal lessons from that prior period of using Guantanamo as a detention center for migrants?
Yeah, I think there are political lessons, Juan, and there are legal lessons. The political lesson is that for 40 years, dating back to the early 1990s, the United States government has used Guantanamo as a legal dumping ground for its political problems. Back then with the Haitians, you will recall that Haitians were sent there for suspected of having HIV and AIDS, and that was a health security crisis that the government said needed to happen. The Center for Constitutional Rights, Yale Law School, Harold Coe, Michael Ratner successfully sued and got Haitian migrants released on that boundary, only to go maybe 10, 12 years later, and they're opening Guantanamo now, the military side, for Guantanamo detainees. The story of the work that the Center for Constitutional Rights and Bahar Azmi is stuff of legend now. There are only 15 people left, but we were able to show, number one, that the people that were then described as the worst of the worst were not in fact so. There are only 15 men left in Guantanamo now, and as we are trying to make good on the failed promise of Barack Obama and Joe Biden to close that terrible facility, here comes Donald Trump, who now wants to open it up for yet another purpose. And he's using national security and the quote-unquote invasion of migrants as the emergency to reopen that base and to house people there for that purpose. I would say one thing that legally that we know that I think is significant here is that Trump himself has said that the reason why he's opening it up is because he doesn't trust the governments to take these people back. And if they take them back, that they're just going to re-release them. So that speaks to me of an indefinite detention regime, which is really, really problematic. The issue that we've been dealing with in Guantanamo, Kristi Noem, when she talked about it, as we just saw, she made no promises or guarantees as to what would happen. She largely said, well, it really depends on what Trump wants to do. That's how we're going to roll. There are potential violations of due process, the rights that these men have in this context, and we have not yet seen a situation where people are put in Guantanamo coming from the United States.
Before we go, Vince Warren, I want to ask you about Trump and the ICC. He's issued sanctions on the International Criminal Court over its investigations of Israeli officials for war crimes in Gaza. The chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, is their first target after arrest warrants were issued for Prime Minister Netanyahu and the former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Can you lay out what you're calling this direct attack on the rule of law?
Absolutely. The Trump administration is saying once and for all, without any doubt, that they are siding with war criminals as opposed to the victims of war crimes. This is not a position that the United States should take, obviously. But I think what's more troubling is it's reopening the executive order that he had done previously, but it's now done in the context specifically of Israel and the United States. The executive order says specifically that because of what the ICC has done with respect to Netanyahu and Gallant, and because the U.S. has been targeted in ICC investigations, therefore the court is illegitimate. This is clearly an attempt to step away from the rule of law for the United States, and more importantly, to shield from any kind of liability or accountability people who are committing war crimes just because they're not signatories to the ICC. And we also know that the reason why they're not signatories to the ICC, because this is exactly the type of things that they were afraid of to begin with. So we're living outside of the law domestically. We're living outside of the law in terms of international human rights. And in every instance, it feels to me that we are siding for the unbridled power of the U.S. and Israel to do whatever the hell that they want, and that there's no court this administration is saying that can stop them.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Vince Warren, Executive Director, Bahar Azmi, the Legal Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Next up, we'll be joined by the acclaimed Palestinian author and poet, Mohammed Al-Kurd. His new book is out today, Perfect Victims and the Politics of Appeal. Stay with us.
It is evident I do better when I feel like the world against me and think I should never win. Can I stop and pocket profit every time I push a pin? But I do not push a pin. The pin and the pin that imprison all my kin and my partners and my friends. The politicians that sponsor the prisons that they in. I got partners coming home from rocking 20 in the pen, trying to make amends with baby mamas, get to know they kin. And they cannot sell no marijuana, law won't let them in. Man, let her out, but will not let us in. It is evident I do better when I feel like the world against me and think I should never win. Can I stop and pocket profit every time I push a pin? But I do not push a pin. The pin and the pin that imprison all my kin and my partners and my friends. The politicians that sponsor the prisons that they in. That include the past, the former, current, and ex-president. You can quote it like I wrote it, signature by Michael Wynn. Swear to God that I go hard and that's as hard as MC Ren. I don't need a reverend. I will not show reverence. Auntie say I'm arrogant, I say I'm intelligent. If God truly know my heart, then why would I bow to men? Now I only go to churches where they welcome worthless men who had to get it out the mud and rise up out the sediment. Catch me early like Sunday school, I'm as clean as my Sunday suit. Pastor play you for fool, me I just keep it cool. He tell me trapping dirty, ask for my dirty money. Talk and wash away my sins like Jesus opened the laundry.
By Killer Mike and Ty Dolla $ign. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We spend the rest of the hour with the acclaimed Palestinian writer, Mohammed Al-Kurd. His new book is out today, Perfect Victims and the Politics of Appeal. The book's publication comes at a time when even books about Palestinians are seen as a threat to the Israeli state. On Sunday, Israeli police raided two locations of the educational bookshop, a beloved Palestinian-owned store in occupied East Jerusalem. Israel detained the bookstore owners, Mahmoud and his nephew, Ahmad Muna, who were held for two nights before being released earlier today. Ahmad spoke after his release.
We have just been released after 2 days of arrest. I have been released. Mahmoud is, we are waiting for his release. This arrest was brutal. The bases are not clear. We have been released today with conditions. We have to stay at home for 5 days of arrest, and we are not allowed in the shops for 20 days. It was a brutal, hard arrest, and it's obvious that there are no charges so far, so we are there's nothing to be that we're held for.
Witnesses said the Israeli police used Google Translate during the raid to determine the names of books in Arabic. He said, quote, anything they didn't like, they took. Their reports books seized included children's coloring book titled From the River to the Sea and Noam Chomsky's book Gaza in Crisis, which he co-wrote with the Israeli scholar Ilan Pappe. Our guest, Mohammed Al-Kurd, grew up in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem, where Israel spent years trying to evict Palestinian families in order to give their homes to Jewish settlers. Mohammed Al-Kurd, welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your new book. As you go around the country presenting Perfect Victims, you hear about this bookstore being closed and the owners being arrested. Your thoughts and the significance of going after the books?
I mean, I think this is the attack on the educational bookstore in Jerusalem is yet another saga in the Israeli regime's scholasticide, the attack on culture, scholars. You know, we've seen them literally bomb every single university in the Gaza Strip. And this, the educational bookstore is, in fact, not the first bookstore in Jerusalem to be closed down, its owners arrested. So there is, you know, a criminalization of thought, a criminalization of the intellect, really. And we've seen this extend even to the realms of social media, where so many thousands of the people who have been arrested in the past 15 months have been arrested over Facebook posts. So the Israeli regime really is waging a war of consciousness against the Palestinians' ability to express national sentiments. And we see this also here in the United States with President Trump saying things like students who support the resistance will have their visas revoked. So there's an attack on, you know, the intellect itself.
And Mohammed Al-Kurd, you asked why Palestinians have to preface their support for the struggle against the occupation with some kind of statement distancing themselves from resistance actions like the attacks of October 7th of 2023. Why is this problematic? While supporters of Israel are never expected to decry the everyday violence of the occupation.
Because it's racist, because there's an impossible standard, there's an impossible demand made of the Palestinians to be, you know, for lack of a better expression, perfect victims, to portray themselves in this with this ethnocentric civility that adheres to Western guidelines. Otherwise, they would be deserving of death, they would be deserving of being bombed. And to reject this is to say that the Declaration of Human Rights is unconditional. And it's universal. And to reject this is to say that, you know, we believe in dignity. We don't believe in having to shrink ourselves or to perform a different script in order to be awarded freedom and dignity. It's these are things we are entitled to.
And I wanted to ask you about the slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. This became a flashpoint. It's still a flashpoint in the United States for attacking pro-Palestinian groups for being anti-Semitic or anti-Israel. Yet many in the Israeli government, in the current Israeli government, actually support from the river to the sea as an Israeli state, and no one raises a fuss about it.
Yeah, of course, because the issue is not the statement itself. The issue is who says it. The Israelis could say from the river to the sea and more. They could say all kinds of explicitly genocidal statements. And yet, with us, they have to read between the lines. They have to infer and look for the hidden insidiousness in such chants. But it's comical, in my opinion, that we are being often interrogated about our chants, about what we say on social media. Meanwhile, when we talk about them, we're talking about bombs and airstrikes and burning people alive in their tents and hospital beds.
Mohammed, before we talk about your title, Perfect Victims, I just want to ask about your background, because we repeatedly interviewed you here and when you were in Sheikh Jarrah. And for people to understand that neighborhood and what happened there and the people involved being the leaders of Israel today, talk about the occupation of Sheikh Jarrah and what happened in your own home.
Yeah, I mean, the story of our home is as unique and absurd as it is common. This is a neighborhood where tax-exempt charities, registered United States settler organizations, Jewish American organizations, will come and claim our homes by divine decree, and they will exploit an already asymmetrical judiciary that is built by settlers for settlers to say, your homes are ours, and we have the right to kick you out of them. And so I, like many, many Palestinians, grew up with quite literally an American settler in my house. And it's...
Wait a second. Now, you're 25 right now.
26. Yeah.
26. Yeah. When was your home, were you forced to share it with someone who wasn't in your family?
It was about 2009. 2009, I came home from school and half of our house was gone. There was a settler inside it, a settler from Long Island. And, you know, right across the street from us, our neighbors, the Ghawi family and the Hannoun family, had lost the entirety of their home to settler organizations. And, you know, across the years, these settler organizations have gotten more and more funding. And like you said, their accomplices and people who work for them and people who lead these organizations have found their way increasingly to the government. But this is indicative of a larger...
They set
larger
up offices in Sheikh Jarrah.
Yeah, they set up offices in Sheikh Jarrah. They kind of use our homes as the home basis to build their electability, their popularity, because the Israeli public is really eager to see this kind of desperation, to see this kind of brutality, and it invokes a sense of safety in the Israeli public to see their politicians literally in the backyards of Palestinians saying, "We will take these homes, we will Jewidize them, we will colonize them."
And your home today?
Well, my home today, like 8 others, we have managed through a massive, massive global solidarity campaign to postpone the expulsion orders. But we still hang in the balance. We don't know what's going to happen in the next few years.
How does that fit into your title, Perfect Victims?
Well, I mean, to do a global campaign and to demand solidarity for our... for our neighborhood, you know, we were told and we were taught to perform this role of to read the script of the perfect victim. So to tell you more, you know, I grew up as a child, as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, we would have journalists, diplomats, all kinds of people visit our neighborhood as though it's some kind of zoo. And I remember constantly I would talk to them, I would show them, you know, photos of the brutality that the settlers raised against us, and I would be pulled to the side by, you know, other concerned diplomats or journalists, and they would tell me, you shouldn't use this phrase, you should use that phrase. And it got into a point that even as a child, I would correct my grandmother when she would refer to the Jewish American settlers in our home as Jewish. I would say, no, don't mention that. But this kind of obfuscation, this kind of omission was kind of drilled into us. And then you grow up and you have internalized this entire framework of editorializing yourself, of curating yourself in a way that is non-offensive to the Western gaze. And then you begin to curate and editorialize all the people around you. You look at people who have suffered pager attacks in South Lebanon, people who have had their homes demolished in the Gaza Strip, and you think, what is the way I can make this victim, this young victim, non-offensive or compelling to a Western racist audience? When you At some point, you have to liberate yourself from these shackles and say, actually, this is the victim. This is the person, this is the oppressed, not the oppressor, not the perpetrator. And we should shift our focus and scrutinize the perpetrators, the oppressors, the colonizers, the focal point and the root cause of all of the violence in Palestine, which is ultimately Zionism.
Mohammed, I want to ask you how Donald Trump's recent comments on Gaza tie into what's at the heart of your book. He's described Gaza as, quote, a big real estate site, and basically said that he doesn't believe Palestinians should be able to return once they've been removed.
I mean, ultimately, this so-called conflict has always been about the land, and any obfuscation of that fact is simply dishonest. Zionist greed has always been about Palestinian land. American interest in Palestine has been about keeping up a certain status quo, a military status quo in the Middle East, but it's also been about exploiting natural resources. I mean, Gaza is rich in natural gases, but what I think Donald Trump is doing is that he is dropping the script of the State Department, the official American script, and just saying things as they are without a filter, and that is helping people understand the long-term American project. Because as disgusting and as abhorrent as Trump's comments were about creating property on the Gaza Strip, it would have never been possible had it been not for the Democratic Party and President Biden flattening Gaza and allowing the flattening of Gaza in the first place.
Can you talk about Shireen Abu Akleh as you talk about her in Perfect Victims, the renowned Al Jazeera journalist who was shot dead by an Israeli sniper, though she was wearing the helmet and the flak jacket. She was outside of the Jenini refugee camp. And how you feel she has been described?
I mean, I want to quote Palestinian scholar Urba Othman. She uses this phrase that Shireen Abu Akleh was killed twice. One, by the Israelis, and the second time when we all started to refer to her as an American. You know, and we did this for a good cause. We had the best interest, the best intentions. We think that Americans will be exonerated, will be compelling in ways that Palestinians aren't, right? It's every day that a Palestinian journalist gets killed, but it's not every day that an American journalist gets killed. But when we refer to Shireen Abu Akleh as an American, we are not increasing her chances of justice, but in fact, we are divorcing her from the remainder of her people. We're exceptionalizing her from the very people that she was part and parcel of. And Shireen Abu Akleh was never a bystander. She was never silent. She was always on the side of justice. In 2002, during the Jenin massacre, she was digging with her bare hands in the rubble, helping mothers look for their children. This is not, and this kind of paradigm that separates the journalists from the rest of their people is really like an outdated paradigm, I think, and it does a lot more harm than good. It doesn't humanize people. It actually exceptionalizes them. It transcends them into this kind of infallible status that nobody else in their peers can ascend to.
And, I wanted to ask you, while so much attention has been focused on the Israeli wars in Gaza and in Lebanon, talk about what the situation is right now in the West Bank for Palestinians, and has it ever been at this crisis level in the past?
No, I mean it's horrifying what's happening in the occupied West Bank, and it's like you said, it has never been at this level of brutality. UNRWA reports that there's been 40,000 Palestinians displaced. We are seeing the Jenin refugee camp and other places in the West Bank bombed every single day. There are more and more martyrs. And we've heard, you know, many months ago that the Israelis, gave the settlers 200,000 rifles. And you see these rifles while you're walking around the West Bank.
We're going to have to leave it there now, but we're going to do part two right afterwards and post it at democracynow.org. And I want to ask you about your dedication to Dr. Rafet Al-Arir. His body was just found. Mohammed Al-Kurd, his new book is out today, Perfect Victims. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Hi, I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Rebecca.
We're the hosts of Sociologic, broadcasting live at CJSF 90.1 FM from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday.
Tune in to hear meaningful conversations exploring all ideas through a sociological lens.